It's on now. There we go. So, what's on the top is what we allow everybody to see. But what's underneath, that's what we like to cover up. It's such a great picture of us, because what we present is what we is presentable. But what's underneath, and that's where what we're talking about, our true thoughts, our failures, our pain, our trauma, our abuse, our grief, our disappointments, our fears, our insecurities, depression, addiction, shame, guilt, all the things that we like to keep covered up. And you can't blame any of us, right? I mean, who likes to talk about that stuff? It's not something that is pleasant. When you go to a job interview and they ask you, well, what are your strengths? That's easy. It's easy to say, well, here are my strengths. Here's what I can do well. Here's why you should hire me. Well, what are your weaknesses? And we know what they are, but it's so hard to talk about what we're not good at, what we struggle with. And when we talk about our brokenness today, you can see in your notes, it's quite a bit of notes today because there's so much to talk about. But we're going to talk about, you know, there's obviously physical abuse, which is pretty obvious, right? Physical abuse, to be beaten, to be abused physically, whether it's as an adult or as a child. And I'm not talking about spanking. My mom spanked me, but I never felt like she was abusing me. It was always appropriate. It was always when I deserved it, and it never crossed the line to abuse. I spanked my kids, and I always made sure that it was never more than just three spankings, just three, no matter how mad I was. And I followed the advice that I heard from Dr. James Dobson to never discipline your children while you're angry. So if I was angry, I calmed down and I cooled myself down as much as I could. I can't say I was perfect. But we're not talking about discipline. We're talking about physical abuse. But then there's also sexual abuse, which is obvious as well. We know what that is. We know it when we see it. We know it when it's happened to us. And even more recently, it's in the last few years with the Me Too movement and women being able to come out and speak out more, we realize even at here in New York, right, at the level of the governor's office, there's been sexual harassment, what could be called abuse, even if it's not physical, but to some degree, at the highest office of the state. And we know that it's gone on even at the highest office of the nation. In Hollywood, we know it when we see it. And thank God that more and more women, and they're not the only ones, but more and more people who have suffered are finding their voice and being able to speak. But then there's emotional abuse. And a lot of times we think, well, what is that? It's a little harder to see. In the back of your notes, you can refer to it later, but it says that Healing the Scars of Emotional Abuse by Dr. Gregory Jantz. It's a book that I'm going to be referring to a lot and bringing out these 13 points. He brings out more than 20 signs of emotional abuse. I'm only going to look at 13 today, but we will cover this in the course that's coming in September. And I want you to start signing up for that course now. You can use the blue card and just write Empower Course and put your name on it and contact information and put it in the offering or in the boxes today to indicate that you want to be a part of that class. But he mentions in opening, in the very first chapter, he talks about a young man named David who at the age of 15 tried to end his life. He says David had never been sexually abused and there was no physical abuse. But he had been abused nonetheless. He was broken. Well, why did this young man who was a star football player want to take his own life? Well, his dad had grown up being a star football player throughout his school career. And he put all of that pressure on his son. At first, his son loved football because of his dad's acknowledgement and praise. And he was good at it. He was built for football. He was big. He was strong. He was fast. And he was succeeding. But eventually, no matter of success on the field was good enough for dad. Kept pushing him. It was never good enough. And it became so heavy, so hard, the expectations that at 15 he tried to take his own life. Because of that attempt, he was no longer able to, he survived, but he was no longer able to play football. So he thought, maybe now my dad, that pressure will be relieved. Maybe dad, my dad now can see me for who I am and what I want to do. And what did this young man, David, want to do? He wanted to be an artist. And he was good at it. But his dad never appreciated his artwork, never saw it as valuable. If he wasn't playing sports, he didn't matter to him. And all of the father's attention now went to his younger sister, who was also an athlete. And David was invisible in his own home. And it got so bad that at 18, he tried again, and that time he was successful. So the author, he mentioned, if you think words don't matter, they do. Quentin Tarantino is a Hollywood bigwig, a top producer and director in Hollywood. He's worth $120 million. There's a story recently about him that he's in his late 50s, maybe early 60s. And there's a story about him where he had been interviewed and asked about his money and his family. And he says, I have never given my mother 1 cent of what I've made. Except for one time that he helped her with some back taxes. He says, other than that, there's been no Elvis Cadillac for mom. There's been no house for mom. You know, like how many football players have we seen or athletes? They get that first check and they buy their mom a house. Or they buy their mom a car. Well, Quentin Tarantino, he's got $120 million. He could buy her 20 homes, but he hasn't bought her a home. He hasn't bought her a car, not 1 cent. And when asked why, he says, well, when he was young, and he was 12 years old, he was writing screenplays. He wanted to be a writer. That's what he wanted to do. And his mom kept telling him, no, don't do it. And she got on his case and said, you're never going to, you know, don't, you're not going to succeed. You need to do good in school. She wanted him to focus on his studies. And then he said, when I become famous and successful, you're not going to get 1 cent of my money. He was 12 years old. Here he's about 60. And he remembers her words and his words back to her. You think words don't matter? And he says this in that interview. He says, and he says it too. He says, if you think your words don't matter to your children, you're wrong. So, let's look at some of the examples that the Bible gives us before we get into the 13 that Dr. Jantz brings out in his counseling that he has seen. Proverbs 11:9 says, with their mouths, the godless destroy their neighbors, but through knowledge, the righteous escape. Right? Through their mouths, the godless destroy their neighbors. They're not burning their neighbor's house down. They're destroying them and cutting them down with their words. Proverbs 16:24. Gracious words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. Right? On the one hand, you have one destroying with words. On the other hand, gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweet. I mean, you've ever had that, those words of encouragement, that person who is able to lift you up with their words? Proverbs 18:21 says, the tongue has the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit. Power of life and death. I mean, it does. Look at the story of David, the young man. Even the story of Christ. It was false testimony that got him crucified. There are plenty of stories in our own time of people who have been falsely accused and then they're set free 30 years later because of false testimony. The tongue has the power of life and death. And those who love it will eat of its fruit. Jesus talked about it. When he talks about in Matthew chapter 12, he's talking about the heart. And he says, you know, from the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. What it's saying is really a reflection of, again, that room. Are you speaking from the lower room, like we saw last week, or from the upper room where God is in the center, where Jesus is in the center? And he says, the good man, the righteous man, from what is stored up in his heart will either produce good or evil. And then he says these words, but I tell you, that everyone will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every empty word they have spoken. Wow. That scares me a little bit. It's for every empty word that I have spoken. And he goes on and he says, right, for by your words you will be acquitted and by your words you will be condemned. Well, we can't talk about the tongue without and words without looking at James chapter 3. Where James chapter 3 is talking about the tongue, and he says, right, likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by such a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. I want to give you one story from the Bible that illustrates the power of words, and it's from Genesis. Because in the book of Genesis is where we see the promise to a man called Abraham. So God calls a man named Abraham, promises to, through him, bring a nation that will be called Israel, the nation of Israel, through whom Jesus would come and save the world. So he tells that to Abraham. Abraham has a son, and the promise carries from Abraham to his son Isaac. Isaac gets married, and Isaac has twin boys, Esau and Jacob. And when Esau and Jacob are grown, and Isaac is now old, he's knows that his time is near. His time on earth is almost over. So he calls his oldest son, Esau, even though they were twins, Esau was the firstborn and had the right of the firstborn, which would be the two-thirds of the father's possessions and the blessing. And his father then calls Esau over, and he's ready to bless Esau, but he gives him an assignment first. Well, while he's off doing this, Jacob, the younger son, he's told by his mom, hey, you need to get in there quick because your father's about to bless Esau, and all the blessing will fall on him. So they trick Isaac, who already can't see. So Jacob comes in, pretends to be his older brother, comes before his father, and his father then begins to bless him. There's no contract, there's no words, there's no lawyers, there's no witnesses. It's just verbal. It's words. And he says to Jacob, just kind of summarizing, but he says to Jacob, he promises on Jacob the blessing of the promise that God had given, the richness of the dew of the earth, right, of the heavens, and of the produce of the crops and of fields, and that he will be blessed. And whatever he touches, God will bless. And he promises all of this blessing to Jacob. And Jacob then leaves, having received the father's blessing spoken with words. And a little while later, Esau comes up and says, Dad, I'm here. I did what you asked me to do. Isaac freaks out. He's like, what do you mean you're here? Who are you? Esau, your son. Oh, then who was it I just blessed? And then Esau is like, that thief, that brother of mine, he has stolen my birthright and my blessing. And then he cries out to his dad, well, Dad, isn't there something you can still say for me? Did you not reserve a blessing for me? Now, in our American mindset, we would just simply think, because we have lost the power, the understanding of the power that our words have. We would just simply think, oh, well, wait a minute. Jacob, come here. That was not meant for you. I didn't mean it for you. I meant it for Esau, so I take it back. Doesn't apply to you. So now, Esau, I bless you. That's what I think when I read it. That's what I would probably do. Like, oh, no, you tricked me. That doesn't count. That's not for you. Isaac tells Esau, he says, what can I give you? I've given him everything. I've given him the blessing of the rains and the fields and the flocks, and there's nothing left for you. You will become a mighty people also, but you will always kind of struggle in hostility with your brother. You will be at war with him. You're gonna struggle. That's what he tells Esau. Because the words that he had spoken over Jacob could not be taken back. It was a blessing. And the Bible says, in our words is the power to bless and the power to curse. What Quentin Tarantino said that day was kind of a curse in a sense. I will never give you. You will not see one single penny. Well, as in the book, Healing the Scars of Emotional Abuse, Dr. Jantz goes through and identifies a number of different things that he has seen, manifestations, things that he has seen that he illustrates, and we're going to go through them one by one. We're going to look at 13 of them today. The first is the overbearing opinion. The overbearing opinion. And this is the person who has an opinion about everything. He mentions this young woman named Carrie, and he says her mom had an opinion about everything. Nothing was too insignificant for her mom to not have an opinion about. anything. Her makeup, her clothes, the TV show she was watching, the music she was listening to, the friend she was going out with, the boyfriend she had, everything her mom had an opinion about. And it was always the opposite opinion of Carrie. Have you ever met that kind of person? Whatever you want to do, there's somebody else, they always think that what you're doing is wrong. They always have an opinion, and it's never a good opinion. It's always that they have a different, and their opinion is the better opinion. Nothing is too insignificant. And the thing is that when it comes to opinions, there are facts, there are opinions, and there are feelings. Facts are facts, right? The sun is out. Okay, it's a fact. This shirt is white. It's a fact. But then there are opinions. For example, Tampa Bay Buccaneers won the Super Bowl. That's a fact. It's a fact. They won this last Super Bowl. They won it. I might say, and Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback of all time. Now, some of you would not agree with that. You think, okay, that's not a fact. That's my opinion. And then even further, our feelings. Opinions and feelings, they're our own. Facts are facts, but the overbearing opinion treats every single opinion as a fact. Their opinion is a fact. What you think, no, that you're wrong, because my opinion is the one that matters. It's constantly putting our opinions on others all the time. And a person who is constantly told that their opinion, their choices are wrong, how do you think they grow up? Second-guessing every decision they make? Not trusting their own intuition, their own voice, their own convictions, or looking for someone so dominant in their personality to fill that role and basically tell them what they should be thinking, feeling. The overbearing opinion. And let me mention, when we look through these, I want you to take a moment with everyone and ask yourself. And when this is constant, like in the life of this young woman named Carrie, when it's constant, it's obvious how that can affect us. Most of us probably haven't gone through the constant barrage of abuse, but I can tell you, just like Quentin Tarantino remembered what his mom said to him when she was 12, there are some words that teachers have said to me that I remember that teacher, and I remember what they said. In all of fourth grade or in all of third grade, what I remember is not what they taught me about history. I remember when they wounded me. My sisters didn't constantly hurt me, but there are a few times growing up that here I am 20, 30 years later, 40 years later, and they still hurt. So it doesn't have to be constant, but obviously if it is constant, it's going to really impact us. But what I also want us to see as we're looking at this and identifying, yeah, I can identify that I experienced that. But I also want to ask, can you identify that you are also doing that? The second one is the person who is always right. Some of these are very similar, but he very carefully brings out the difference between the two. In the overbearing opinion, every single thing the person has an opinion about, everything. The temperature in the room, your room is too hot, it's too cold, the shades, everything, they have an opinion about every single thing. The person who is always right, they may not have an opinion about everything, but when they do have an opinion, they have to be right. He gives an example of a young man who went to buy his first car. And he saw the car that he wanted. It was a good deal. His dad comes with him, just like most dads do. Okay, well, let me check it out. Let's look under the hood. Let's kick the tires. And his dad's like, no, this is not a good... The fuel pump is probably going to go. The tires need to be replaced already. And halfway in, his son just tuned him out because his son wanted this car. And he knew, the son was not ignorant. He knew that the tires were going to have to be replaced soon. And he knew that some of the engine parts would have to be replaced. But he didn't care. It was the car he wanted. It was the one that he chose. Well, he bought it. And first time it broke down, he's like, okay, he prepared himself for it. And his dad just began with those words, I told you so. But not just I told you so, everything. This is why, and I told you. And he begins, and see, the person who is always right, again, they may not have an opinion about everything you do, but whenever they do make an opinion, they have to be right no matter what. And even if the evidence is against them, they manipulate it, they twist it, they turn it around on you. So somehow everything still shows that they're right, Even when everything is showing, and you're like, but no, this isn't the case. You're wrong. They will turn it on you. Have you ever known somebody like that? The person who is always right. The judge and jury. The judge and jury, this is the person who makes all the decisions. But, you know, when you're a child, when you're a parent, you're supposed to make the decisions, right? You're supposed to make the decisions. However, as children grow up, their opinions and their feelings should be considered. Where do we want to go to dinner tonight? Do we want to go to dinner tonight? What movie do we want to see? Where are we going to go on vacation? What sports should we play? What should we plan on this summer? All of those things, you begin to incorporate others. The judge and jury, he makes not only the rules, but he makes the laws. And the point is that he doesn't just set it like on a standard, like you can know what to expect. The judge and jury makes every decision for everybody. Nobody else has a voice, but he makes the decisions based on what he or she wants, what's in it for them, how they feel. They don't feel like going out tonight? We're not going out tonight. Doesn't matter if everybody else wants to. Tomorrow night, nobody wants to go out, but he wants to go out? We're all going out. Right? Whatever they say goes, nobody else has a voice. And they'll change the rules constantly to fit whatever it is that they want. That's what he describes as the judge and the jury. They make all the decisions constantly for everyone. Then there's the put-down artist. The put-down artist is kind of self-explanatory, isn't it? It's the one who uses insults to gain control. And let me mention this. All of these actions and attributes, attitudes, personalities, are all an attempt to gain control. When we do these things, we're doing them because we want to control the situation. Every single time, it's an attempt to control the person in our lives. The put-down artist does that with insults, with belittling. So you give the story, we've all probably done this at some point, but the brother who, he says, hey, I'm gonna apply to this job. And the older brother is like, are you kidding? They'll never hire you. You're no good at anything. Well, no, I'm good. I work hard. I can learn fast. Yeah, right. Then why are your grades so bad? Why can't you do good in school? Well, my grades aren't that bad. Your grades are not that good. You're too stupid to get into that school. You're too weak to play that sport. It's just belittling. And really, we understand that person who's doing the belittling is doing that in order to lift themselves up. They have to push others down. They're probably more insecure than the person they're belittling. But it's insults. It's constantly putting someone else down. And again, this may happen once in a while. Every kid, every person, but do you have someone at work that everything is always an insult? The next is the great guilt giver. And this one, at least the story that he tells, really breaks my heart. He talks about a young woman who comes into his office. She's 80 pounds. And thinks she needs to lose more weight. And as he starts to talk with her, he realizes her mom was a dancer. She got married, got pregnant, had a baby. And after she had the baby, the husband left. And this little girl, as a baby growing up, was told from as early as she can remember, by her mom, words like these. I could have been a great dancer if I didn't get pregnant with you. I could have been a great dancer if I didn't get pregnant and gain 50 pounds while I was pregnant. I could have been a great dancer if your father didn't leave us and then I had to go to work to take care of you. She grew up with all the blame and responsibility for her mother's failures on herself. And the person who's receiving all of that might think the person who's blaming them doesn't care about them, but actually, you're the most important person to them. Because without you, they would have to take responsibility for their own actions or find somebody else to blame. The young lady was never beaten by her mom. or sexually abused by your mom, but constantly bearing the weight of the burden of the guilt that she ruined her mother's life. Well, what does that do to a child when now they're supposed to be an adult, supposed to be able to live their own life, supposed to be able to function healthy in a healthy way? The next is the preacher. This one cuts close to home for me. You could call it the preacher, you could call it the lecturer or the teacher. It's the person who has a sermon ready in their back pocket. It's the person that, and I do have a tendency, this is a person who really is a master of words, and they have a lesson to explain. So it may not be belittling, but when something happens, they have all the reasons. They have a sermon. They have a three-point outline, and you're just sitting there waiting for it to be over. Okay, how long is this sermon going to last? Right? It's the preacher. It's the teacher. And I've had to, you know, we've all at some point done some of these things, and I know I've seen myself doing this and had to take a step back and say, okay, they don't need to hear that right now. They know they did wrong. It's not going to help by going to preacher mode. The seventh is the historian. And the historian, also very self-explanatory. Where 1 Corinthians 13 says love keeps no record of wrongs? The historian does. He gives a story of a husband who was looking for a fight. She was ready. She was armed. She was preparing. Anything could set her off. She had had a bad day at work. She was upset because she had gained a few pounds, even though she had been trying to eat healthy. And a few days earlier, her husband told her that the dress she was wearing looked tight on her. It doesn't matter that she asked him how the dress looked on her. And every man knows in here that that's a rookie move. The answer is always, you look amazing, dear. You look beautiful. But women also, that's really an unfair question. Well, he answered it. He says, yeah, it looks a little tight on you. Anyway, he's coming in now this one day, and she's just ready to explode. As soon as he walks in the door, just boom, boom, she just starts shooting at him these accusations, and she's upset. She's arguing, and he's like, what are you talking about? And she's like, well, you don't understand or appreciate what I do. And he's like, yeah, I do. I appreciate what you do in the house. She's like, oh, yeah, when? When's the last time? Well, I don't know. I mean, I've last week. What was it you said? I don't remember. You don't remember? I can tell you, last Thursday, I thanked you for this. Last Wednesday, I appreciated you for this. And she says, I remember every mean thing you've done to me and said over the last 10 years. And he said, everything? How can you remember all of that? And she says, are you calling me a liar? I mean, that's the person, it's kind of like the cartoons. They pull out the list and it just goes all the way down the aisle. And they start bringing up everything, every single time. The historian. Then there's the ventaholic. This person uses screaming, yelling to control the situation. He gives the example of a young boy who comes home from school and loves school. He loves going to class. But all of a sudden, he's coming up with excuses on why he doesn't want to go. He doesn't feel good. His stomach hurts. His head hurts. Mom, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. So finally, she's like, come on. What's going on? Why don't you want to go to school? You love school. Are the boys or some friends bullying you? Or are you having problems with friends? Like, no, Mom, I just don't want to go. And then finally, she kept persisting. And he says, it's Mrs. And he says the teacher's name. What is it about the teacher? She yells all the time. Like, I mean, I've been in the class, the mom says. I've been in the class. I know she has raised her voice some, but he's like, Mom, when you're not there, when the parent isn't around, it's 10 times worse. It's just constant yelling and yelling and yelling. And let me mention that we're all talking about words here, but one of the things that he mentions is actually the absence of words. The silent treatment is another one that he also mentions is a form of controlling. Then there's the intimidator. The intimidator uses threats to control. The intimidator says things like, if you don't, I will. A little boy might say, if you don't do this, then I'm going to take my game and go home. Right? Learning from a very young age. It's the wife that says, if you don't, I'm walking out. I'm leaving. Or it's the boyfriend that says, if you leave me, I'm going to hurt myself. All to control the other person. Intimidating with threats. And then there's the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, if you know the story, Dr. Jekyll was a doctor, well educated, but Mr. Hyde was this monster he would turn into. And the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is when it's not two personalities in that clinical sense, it's two faces. It's the teenage girl who comes to church and her dad is gloating over her. She's such a good student. She's great. She's on the swim team. She's got great grades. But at home, she never does anything right. At home, her grades are not good enough. At home, there's a different parent at home. And when they go to church, they're different parents at church. And they grow up understanding and believing that there are two different things, two different people. So they start growing up thinking, who do I need to be at church? Who do I need to be at work? Who do I need to be at home? And never really understanding who they are, but always trying to be what other people want them to be. And there's another one here that's like that. It's the illusionist. I'm just mentioning it because it's like that. The illusionist is the one who, they are two separate people also, but they are so charismatic. It's the man who just everybody tells you, man, your husband is such a great guy. I just can't believe you're so lucky to be married to him. He has everybody thinking he's the best in the world, but at home, he's a totally different person. And he's so good at it that if you did leave, everybody would think that there was something wrong with you. Because he's so good at convincing everyone with his charisma. The 11th is the person who plays favorites. Again, that's obvious, right? The person who plays favorites. But it's also very important when it goes to extremes. I mean, we have to be so, so careful. Because if you're like, my experience was that my kids were constantly asking me, who do I like more? Who's my favorite? Did your kids ever ask you that? Yeah, who's my favorite? Who do you like more? Or they would say to each other, you could hear them, well, mommy likes me more, daddy likes me more. I had to be so careful, even as others would say things to them, because as they were growing up, even today, people look at our family picture, or Jared will walk in and say, oh, you look just like Tony, you look just like your dad. Caleb will come in, and Caleb favors Christy's side of the family. Oh, you look at your mom or your grandfather. Caleb's the only one with blue eyes, like his mom. Caleb's the only one with curly hair, like his mom. I remember one time my sister commented on how pretty his curls were. I don't like my curls. Because there was, as a young kid, he was already thinking, Jared and Olivia, and they have Bobby's hair, they have Bobby's eyes, and it's not, you know, as an adult, he's okay. So it's okay to have blue eyes, but as a 5-year-old, as a boy, he wants to be able to identify with his dad. A 5-year-old probably doesn't want to be told all the time, if he's a 5-year-old boy, you look like your mom. Right? So I had to be very, very intentional at nurturing him and letting him know he was daddy's boy, right? That that I loved him and I was proud of him and celebrating who he is. The role reverser, or I'm sorry, the person who plays favorites. One girl constantly asked her dad to go to her swim meets, and he never went. But he hardly ever missed his son's football games. So playing favorites. Then there's the role reverser. We're almost done. This one is subtle. And let me say, most of us, when we're doing these things, we don't realize. We can do these things without realizing that we're doing them. But the role reverser many times happens in a home where there's been a broken home or divorce. Because in a home, you have mom and dad are the authority. They give the direction. They give the rules. And, you know, dad might go out with his son and play soccer or take him to the movies and get some popcorn. And it's, you know, you're my little buddy. We're having a great time at the movies. But we come home and dad is dad again. But when dad only gets little Billy on the weekends, dad wants his buddy back. Dad doesn't want to talk about discipline. He doesn't, and it's all like, let's have pizza, let's play video games, let's go watch movies. And dad has now become his buddy, not his dad. And maybe mom, she takes the child and now unleashes all of her pain, and he becomes her confidant, her counselor, her shoulder to cry on, her emotional support, instead of being her child. And when those roles get reversed, it affects us, it damages us, it breaks us. And then the last one that I'm talking about, like I said, there's many more, is the wrath of God. The wrath of God deals with you, just like the commander-in-chief was in charge, made the decisions, the right opinion, he has a right opinion about everything, and his opinion is always right, and he can use all the facts to prove, or twist all the facts to prove his point. Well, the wrath of God is that same person who now takes every scripture to prove that they're right and you're wrong. To prove, using the Bible and twisting verses and manipulating verses in order to prove and to put guilt on you because you're not obeying God's will. God doesn't want you to do that. And it's okay to say that sometimes, but the wrath of God is a person who uses the Bible as a weapon instead of as an encouragement. As we conclude here, get near to the end, you'll see a long list of things there inside your program. For those that are, I'm going to read them for those that are listening online, and everyone else can read along with me. But these are the effects, because as they have studied these effects on us, we realize that they don't only affect our hearts, they can affect our bodies and our lives. So listen, let's read some of these quotes. When you view life as unstable, anxiety, tension, and fear result. When you learn to second-guess yourself, confusion and feelings of disconnect result. When nothing you do ever seems to be right, insecurity, guilt, and shame result. When others tell you that you are always wrong, indecision and inaction result. When you stop having the energy to fight it all, apathy and depression result. When you have finally had it, rage results. When you have been hurt by those you love, love is viewed as a risk, so you don't open up your heart. When living is so painful, addictions are acceptable because they numb the pain. When the mind is a jumble of emotion, emotional chaos, the body and its systems break down. When you can't control your negative emotions, you become the very person you hate. There's a list there of seven things: fear, anger, guilt, panic attacks, phobias, allergies, low self. And he mentions depression, anxiety, all of these can be symptoms physically of brokenness. But I want to, you'll see the first three have a line for you to write in. I want to fill these three in. When it comes to fear, he's noticed many people who suffer with fear also have stomach or digestive problems. Have you ever gotten so nervous that your stomach gets twisted? And we say, oh, my stomach is in knots. Or even if you're excited, but you're like nervous excited, like your first date, the butterflies in your stomach, that's still nervousness. You have to get up and give a presentation or a speech, or you're going to an interview, and you got to go to the bathroom before you go in. Fear, he has found, can manifest itself physically in our bodies with stomach and digestive problems. Then there's anger. And he says many times people who suffer with anger, like Esau did, probably with Jacob, it manifests in their head many times with migraines. And migraines can be debilitating. But he says, again, when you have so much anger built up, it can be debilitating and lead to headaches and migraines, and it can manifest many times in your head. And the third is guilt. And he says guilt he has found many times, like that young woman who was only 80 pounds, it can manifest itself in your entire body. Chronic fatigue, unexplained illnesses. He talks about a woman who, her doctor, she was having asthma attacks. The doctors couldn't see anything physically wrong with her. The MD, nothing physically wrong that could explain it, but she was having panic attacks and asthma, not able to breathe. So he referred her to a psychologist, and as they begin to talk and discuss, he starts to realize all that she had been through and started to realize that her body was so overwhelmed that it was literally suffocating herself. And I want to mention two people that I know, two brothers. These are people that I know personally. I'll call one Michael and I'll call the other Aaron. They grew up in a very abusive home. Physical abuse and verbal abuse. As far as I know, there was no sexual abuse, but physical and verbal abuse. Their father was an alcoholic and drug addict and very, very abusive. He would come home, beat anyone he wanted to, especially his wife, their mother. Michael was a pretty big guy. And as he got older, he told me about one time where he burst through the bathroom door where his dad was in there. When he opens the door, his dad has a gun pointed to his mom's head. And he jumps in the middle and takes a beating. But thankfully was not shot. Then there's his younger brother, Aaron. His younger brother, his dad continually told him that he wasn't his. I mean, if you saw the two of them, they're carbon copies. Like, yeah, that's your son. That's your father. I mean, you look just like him. But he continually said, no, your mom cheated on me. You're not mine. You're not mine. He told him that as he was growing up. I took Michael with me on this trip. As we were going and speaking, and we were in a hotel room, and we were speaking at a college, and I took him with me to experience it. And he had one of his migraines. He suffered from migraines, and he was on the bathroom floor throwing up. He couldn't move, and these episodes could last for days. And I realized that was the first time I had seen anyone suffering from a migraine. He was completely incapacitated. He had so much anger. When I read this book, I realized that's Michael. He has so much anger and resentment towards his dad. Well, Michael didn't only have migraines. He was also very verbally abusive to his wife and his own children. See, a lot of times when people are so full of anger, they've been so abused, they direct it towards other people. They hurt, so they want to make somebody else hurt. It's like the man who gets chewed out by his boss comes home, chews out his wife. His wife chews out the son, and the son kicks the cat. Just goes down the chain. Well, Michael just, when he would get upset, he just would lash out at other people. His brother Aaron was completely different. Aaron, I talked to him, whenever he was at church, whenever he came to see me, he always had a hoodie and his head covered up. I mean, almost completely covered. And I would ask him about it. He says, I don't want anybody to see me. I don't want to be seen. I'm ugly. I hate myself. I don't want to live. Michael, in the same home, was so full of anger that it expressed itself by, I hurt so much, I want to make other people hurt. Aaron was so full of pain that he directed it inside and said, I want to make myself hurt. I'm not good at making others hurt, but I can really hurt myself. So these are the ways. When we're talking about words, right, we think at times, well, they're just words. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. No. Bones heal. And at least you can see that you've been broken. But wounds on the inside, we can cover them up like that iceberg so well. And I want you to think about what God can do. I'm going to give you an opportunity to just come up and receive prayer and be prayed for. But imagine what God can do in us in the next few months, in the next 6 months, if we allow God to go beneath the surface. What could happen in our church? And I mentioned that because coming up to the altar and receiving prayer and going back, the reason that is appealing is because if we stop there, then that's where it stops. You came up, you received prayer, and you went back. Pete Scazzaro, who wrote the book about the iceberg, he said when he started to realize all the dysfunction and brokenness that was in his life, even as he was pastoring a church in New York City, he said it took him on a 2-year journey before he was even able to write that book. And that's good to know, because a lot of times we think, I come to the altar, I pray, I give it to God, and somebody prayed for me, and I go back, and now tomorrow everything's going to be great, I'm going to be healed. And that can happen. But we need to understand that most of the time it's a journey. And that's why we're doing the class starting in September on brokenness and healing. And I'm going to do one on prayer as well. That Irene, I'm thinking about maybe Sundays for that. But God's been speaking to me on prayer, and I think I'd like to do something where I'm able to talk on prayer. The Empower one will be not on Sundays, but another day of the week, maybe Wednesday nights. But if you want to sign up for that, I want you to use the blue card or anything, an envelope, a piece of paper, just write Empower, your name, your contact information, and you can drop it in the box on the way out. But for now, I want us to pray. And I want you to be vulnerable. I want you to just trust the Lord and come up, and there'll be somebody who will come and pray for you. We're not going to fix everything this morning, but we're going to take a step. We're going to take a step forward. So, Patty, if you can come up. And let's just pray. You'll notice that in your program, there is also a prayer. Because as you've been thinking about things, maybe things have come to your mind, maybe people have come to your mind that you have that have either wounded you or maybe people that you've wounded. Maybe you've heard in some of these your own words. And again, it's hard. But there's a prayer there that can guide you into saying, okay, Lord, what are the things I've identified? Yeah, come on up. Come on up. The altar is always open. If you need prayer, I want you to come up. Why don't we stand? Just make it easier for those who might want to slip out and down the aisles and come forward. And this is a good thing. It's a beautiful moment. Those who are up here to pray for you are qualified. They're here to minister to you, to love you, to help you. Father, we open our hearts to you. We want to expose the hurt and the wounds that are there. For some, Lord, I realize it's just as extreme as some of these examples. For most of us, it's a lot more subtle. It's not that deep. But we realize that whenever we are emotionally triggered, we have a tendency. We may not do it all the time, but when we're emotionally triggered, we have a tendency to fall into one of those characters, one of those people. And if that's the case, then there's something there that is triggering that behavior. And this is all about finding healing. An emotional healing, emotional maturity. And I want to invite you. Take that step. And you can allow the Lord to meet you where you are. But I also, again, I want to challenge you or encourage you. Because for some, it's that we need to take that step of letting someone else look under the water with us. Letting someone else look under the surface. With us, at us. Yes, Lord. Yes, Jesus.